Hello and welcome to the Mike Cerulli Show. We're going to take you around the horn in the world of Connecticut politics today. And starting things off, we have State Senator Ryan Fazio of Greenwich joining us. Ryan's a regular on the show. Senator Fazio, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show.
Good to be back with you, Mike.
So some big news broke recently. Senator, you've been named the ranking Senate Republican on the Committee on Finance, Revenue, and Bonding. It's kind of a mouthful of the title. Tell us, what is that position? What does the Finance Committee do? This is a really big move for you.
Yeah, so the ranking member is the top member of the minority party on a committee. So I was named the top Republican senator on the Finance Committee. And the Finance Committee is one of the two big budget committees in the state legislature. It deals with basically revenue, so taxation policy, and bonding policy, so debt-related policy. And the other major budget committee is the Appropriations Committee, which deals with a lot of the spending. And so those two committees are two of the biggest committees and most important committees in the state legislature because they help form the budget and budgetary policies related to the state government. So almost anything under the sun comes through those two committees in order to set the $50 to $60 billion budget that is created every year. And this being the first year of the legislative term will be the one in which the state legislature and the governor agree to and pass a $50 to $60 billion budget. And so I'm very excited to be part of those sorts of discussions and debates that we have when we're trying to make the necessary investments for the state and reduce or limit the tax burden that Connecticut residents pay every year.
So, first of all, congratulations on the new position. Before we go on, I know a lot of our listeners here on the Mike Cerulli Show will know you from your fights on the issue of electricity and energy costs. Will you still remain the top Republican on that committee?
Yes, I will.
Got it.
So I have the exact roles that I want in the state legislature and the state Senate this year. I want to be fighting for lower electric costs. I want to be fighting for lower taxes and smart budget policy. So I'm very excited to get back to work.
Interesting. So let's dive into the tax issues. First of all, you mentioned heading back up to Hartford on the 8th of January for the legislative session that will begin the budget process to set that $50 to $60 billion state budget for the next 2 years. I guess the bottom line I'll ask you, Senator Fazio, is that budget, do you expect it to include any tax hikes? Sounds like you're going to be fighting for tax breaks, but of course, no secret that you're in the minority party.
Yeah, I mean, no new taxes in Connecticut is a issue where I will tie myself to the Senate floor. Connecticut residents are taxed too much already, and I don't think that asking people who are overtaxed in Connecticut, middle-class families, is a valid budgetary policy or reform under any circumstances. But that also means that we can't be raising spending or increasing the spending promises that we have in the state inordinately, and because that will transfer to higher taxes, maybe not this year or next year, but in future years when there is a rainy day. So it's not just a matter of stopping tax increases this year, but it's also a matter of limiting spending and having prudent budgetary controls so that we aren't increasing taxes on middle-class families in 3 years or in 5 years from now.
Interesting. So, Senator Fazio, I know you have some ideas on areas that taxes could be cut, some ideas on areas where taxes could maybe be capped, and I know you are a champion of another idea that would technically be a new tax, but one that would create revenue for the state. Let's start with the areas where you want to cut or cap taxes. You floated an idea of a property tax cap. Tell us about what that is.
So there are other states in the country that cap property taxes. So it limits how much every year municipalities or the state, depending on which state it is, can increase property taxes on residents. We know that in Connecticut, one of the main reasons we have such high taxes is the high level of property taxation. Mm-hmm. That's really actually a regressive tax. It's disproportionately high on lower income residents. It's really burdensome on seniors who have fixed incomes. So I think in Connecticut, we need a property tax cap that will put a limit on how much property taxes can be increased from year to year. So what that would entail is limiting how much, in a nominal fashion, how much property taxes can be increased every single year, while also reducing some of the unfunded mandates imposed on towns and cities, which are part of the reason we have such high property taxes. It's been done in Massachusetts and New York. My view is if Massachusetts and New York can limit property taxes, then certainly Connecticut can. Those aren't exactly bastions of libertarianism or conservatism under any view of the world. Right. So that is going to be a proposal that I've done in the past, but will continue to push in the coming year. And we've started to see a little bit more favorable comments from different constituencies on such an idea.
So you just mentioned a phrase there, Senator Fazio, unfunded mandates, trying to get rid of some of those to alleviate the burdens on local municipalities. I feel like that's one of those terms we hear a lot from legislators, but is never fully explained. When you say unfunded mandate, give us an example of what you're talking about.
So an unfunded mandate would be a state requirement that a municipality do something in a certain way that will increase the cost without the state providing the funding to the municipality for that requirement that they do something that will increase costs. So one example is that if you do certain construction or capital projects, that you have to, take out a bond or an insurance policy of a certain value on the project, that you have to use closed union labor for a project rather than go out competitively to bid for both union labor or non-union labor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things where there's actually, according to one count from the Council on Small Towns in Connecticut, there's over 1,400 unfunded mandates imposed on our towns and cities. So they're discrete, but they add up. To the point that Connecticut has very high burden imposed on local residents, on local taxpayers. And that's why we have such high property taxes overall in the state, because it's death by a thousand cuts. So in exchange for limiting how much the towns and cities can impose in property taxes, they also need to have relief in the form of reductions in the unfunded mandates and all the burdens that those entail.
We're chatting with State Senator Ryan Fazio from Greenwich. He's just been named the top Senate Republican on the Finance Committee, then the legislature. That's the committee that deals with the writing of tax policies and laws. Senator Fazio, we also heard news break recently, as I first reported, that on the House side, the state House side, you'll be joined by State Representative Joe Paletta from Watertown, also a former guest here on the Mike Cerulli Show. Looking forward to working with him. You guys are both new to those ranking member roles in that committee. Are you looking forward to working with Representative Paletta?
Yeah, Representative Paletta is a great guy. He's energetic. He's smart. We represent different parts of the state, but we're friendly and we've worked well together in our limited capacities, crossing paths in the prior years. So, you know, I think you're going to have a lot of energy. It's sad to see Representative Cheeseman go, who was from Eastern Connecticut. She was, I think, a real champion for taxpayers in the state. And I think it's, as Dan Haar wrote in his column, obviously Dan is more liberal leaning, but as he wrote in his column, she was a great champion for the state and an important voice in the state government. So it's sad to see her go. Senator Martin is moving up in leadership as deputy leader for the Senate Republicans. So, the path has been charted for us. Now it's time for me and Joe to get to work in defending Connecticut's taxpayers.
Two younger Republicans, I would note there. We're both in your 30s. We're chatting with State Senator Fazio. We're going to take a quick break here on the Mike Cerulli Show. And when we come back, we're going to discuss with Senator Fazio another new position he has that goes part and parcel with being on the Finance Committee. And that is being on the body that oversees a lot of the states, well, all of the states, borrowing all that debt we talk so much about. And we're also going to talk about a tax idea that Senator Fazio has floated that is technically a new tax, but would bring in some money for the state. So stay with us. We're going to take a quick break right here on WICC. And welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. We are continuing our conversation with State Senator Ryan Fazio of Greenwich. He has just been named the top Republican state senator on the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee of the legislature. Along with that, Senator Fazio will now have a seat on the State Bond Commission, which is separate from the legislative committees. It's a commission that includes senior legislators, a handful of senior legislators, the governor, the attorney general, the comptroller. So a mix of both executive branch and legislative officials. And crucially, this is the body that okays state bonding. Bonding, another word for borrowing. Borrowing, of course, another word for debt. So Senator Fazio, with this new position that you have, what kind of philosophy are you going to be bringing to state borrowing? Because obviously, right, these capital projects, they call them, there is a need, right, as anyone has, if you buy a home or do an addition on your house or something like that, there is a need to borrow money if it's going to pay off down the road. But Connecticut obviously carries a lot of debt, and debt has a cost over time. So tell us about your philosophy as you now join the State Bond Commission.
There are reasons that any organization needs to borrow sometimes and incur some debt sometimes. But the state government of Connecticut, the elected officials in Connecticut, need to realize that when you borrow, you are placing a burden on future taxpayers and future generations. And in Connecticut, there are a couple of recent studies that were released in November and October that shows Connecticut's overall level of bonded debt is now the highest per capita in the entire country. And moreover, it has not really gone down as much as other states have seen their debt burden go down in the years since COVID. And that was a specific study that was issued by the Office of Legislative Research, the nonpartisan research arm of the state government, that I had asked to be conducted. And it found that even though Connecticut is currently on a so-called debt diet,
right,
that was a promise made by the governor. And yes, he has issued less debt than his predecessor while governor.
Yeah.
The overall levels of government debt as a percentage of our state economy has not gone down as much as other states. And so we have now become, I think, the most indebted state per capita in the entire country, which means that we are still issuing more debt than the state's taxpayers can shoulder in burden. And what it also means is that the more you borrow, the more debt service you have in the future, which means it crowds out other vital needs in the state government for our state's nonprofits, social service agencies, for public education, and so on and so forth. So we need to be smart and prudent about how much we issue in debt, because we know future taxpayers are going to shoulder that burden, and they're paying too much already.
Now, Senator Fazio, on the same token, I hear what you're saying there. You and I both know every time the State Bond Commission meets, which is at several points in the year, they have a big agenda with sometimes dozens of items on it. Those items can range from everything from improvements to a local Little League field for as little as $50,000 or $100,000, all the way up to hundreds of millions of dollars for things like long-term transportation infrastructure projects. So those bond packages, some would say they contain a little bit of that old-fashioned pork barrel spending, the Little League fields, the sort of town parks. Not to say that those things aren't important and relevant, but I am curious, you are still a state senator for Greenwich. Are there any priorities and projects in your district that you hope to be able to advocate for now that you have this important role on the bond commission? And kind of in the same sentence as that, I'll ask, do you think that's a productive way to be spending money? Of course, you and I know up at the Capitol, right, every legislator tries to get their little pet projects snuck into the bond commission agendas. It's one of those things that legislators like to brag about, Republican and Democrat. Hey, I brought back $200,000 for a senior senator, or $500,000 to put a sidewalk on a busy street in town. Talk about the politics of getting on that bond commission agenda.
I think, listen, you are articulating the dilemma very well, that there are concentrated benefits of bonding, but there are very diffuse but very significant costs to the average taxpayer who doesn't feel the benefits of most bonding projects. So this is not to say that the bonding should be eliminated. It should just be limited to the point that we can actually reduce our sky-high debt burden in the state. So one of the proposals that I've made in recent years, and I'll continue to make this year or this coming year, is to simply cap our overall bonded debt that is issued every year to the point that we can actually reduce the future burden of debt service to taxpayers in the state. We should still be investing in roads and bridges and schools, but, not every pet project should be funded to the tune of everything that is asked. Mm. And in that way, we can actually create more room in the budget in future years to meet the vital needs that we have in the state that the government should be spending on, and most importantly, finally be able to reduce taxes in a meaningful way on middle-class families in the mm-hmm. state.
So we're chatting with State Senator Ryan Fazio. As we've been saying, he's now the top Senate Republican on the Tax Writing Committee in the legislature. You're a Republican, Ryan. I would consider you a fiscally conservative Republican, or a fiscally, I don't know what other word for it would be, but you're someone who likes to keep an eye on spending and an eye on taxes, which is why I always find it interesting that one of the issues I think you are unique for proposing is actually a new tax. And I know Republicans might recoil at that, but hear me out here. The tax that you proposed is a capital gains tax on the endowment of private universities. And I've heard, and I work for the New Haven television station, I've heard there's a really big private university in New Haven that has like an endowment in the tens of billions of dollars that right now isn't taxed at all. So are you saying specifically that we should be taxing Yale's endowment? And if so, what do you think we could benefit from that? And also, why don't they pay taxes right now?
I am saying that multi-billion dollar university endowments above a certain threshold should be paying capital gains taxes, and that the state of Connecticut should use that marginal revenue to cut middle class and lower middle income taxes
right.
in the state, in a state where taxpayers are paying far too much already, especially middle class and working class taxpayers. This is a policy that has been passed to a small extent at the federal level. So now mm-hmm. multi-billion dollar universities pay a 1.7% capital gains tax on, again, capital gains and dividends, not the overall university endowment,
right.
not the real estate, just the capital gains, the profits that they make on mm-hmm. their investments. You know, I think that's reasonable when you have some universities that only have, 5 or 10,000 students,
right.
but have $20 or $30 billion university endowments. They're basically become hedge funds with small schools attached to them. These are schools that have, 2, 3, 5, 10% acceptance rates, and yet they don't increase the number of seats at their university every
right.
year if they're providing such a great education, rather than simply conferring elite status on a limited number of privileged individuals,
yep.
then I would think that they would expand the number of seats with all the resources they have. But instead, just increasing the number of administrators, and certainly they're increasing the size of the university endowments at a healthy level. I don't propose to do a wealth tax to tax the money sitting there,
yeah.
simply a marginal tax on the profits made on multi-billion dollar endowments, and use that revenue to cut middle-class income taxes in a state where taxpayers are taxed too much already.
Right. Yale does have a $41 billion endowment. It's a pretty big number. I don't think there's any people in Connecticut that have that much money, let alone private institutions. So I wonder, Senator Fazio, is there an ideological element to this too? I've heard this argument from Republicans before, and one of the things they mention is they say, the idea of a university is that it's supposed to provide positive externalities for the surrounding community and state that it's in. Of course, I don't think anyone would argue that Yale hasn't provided a lot of positive externalities for specifically New Haven, for Connecticut, and they would argue for the world. But I've also heard arguments that say, actually, no, ideologically and economically, some of the things that come out of Yale aren't that positive. Do you sort of factor that into your support for taxing their endowment?
Listen, I think that this is a fairness argument. Maybe you could argue that hundreds of millions or a few billion dollars is necessary for an endowment in order to provide educational services. And that's why we have a tax exemption. And I'm not arguing for eliminating that tax exemption. But once you're talking about many, many billions of dollars for just a few thousand students, it's clearly not necessary for educational purposes. Again, that's why I think the analogy of a hedge fund, of a large hedge fund with a small school attached to it, is just mathematically a correct description. That's what many of these universities have become. So, then on top of that, there's the question of the tax exemption or the large discount on property taxes that these universities have as they continuously expand and take other revenue off of their city or town's tax rolls, which means that the property taxes of the existing residents continue to go up. There is a fairness argument here. Yeah. So I'm making a fairness argument and an economic efficiency argument. And it's not about a single university. It's about very, very, very large university endowments per pupil at the school. There should be a very small tax on the profits of those endowments above a certain threshold and use that revenue to reduce middle-class taxes in the state.
Got it. State Senator Ryan Fazio, that's all the time we have here today on the Mike Cerulli Show. But I appreciate you going around the horn with us talking about some of these issues. And again, congratulations on the new position. I'm sure our listeners will hear from you in the very near future.
Thanks, Mike. Talk to you again soon.
We will be right back here on WICC with more of the Mike Cerulli Show. Taking you around the world of Connecticut politics, we're going to head up 91 or the Merritt or however you get up to Hartford and chat with the Hartford State, one of the Hartford State representatives and the Speaker of the Connecticut State House of Representatives. It's a friend of the show, Matt Ritter. Speaker Ritter, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show.
Thanks, Mike. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you as well. So we are right around the corner from the start of the 2025 legislative session. You will gavel the legislature back into session on January 8th. And I wonder if you could give our listeners a preview of what to expect this year.
Yeah, it's going to happen fast. Look, this is our two-year cycle begins in the odd years, right? So the budget is always the number one priority when you're back into session. And we'll be working to get that done, hopefully sometime in the spring. And the state is in a great place. We continue to run large surpluses, but obviously there's going to be a need to strike a balance between our budget reserve fund, prepaying our debt and our pensions, but also investments in childcare, Medicaid rates, nonprofits, higher education. So there's always those balances you have to strike. Elections is probably a big issue too, Mike. As some of the voters who listen to you know, they amended our Constitution. So we no longer have some of the restrictions that we've had in the past. So I think just like people saw early voting, you'll see no excuse absentee balloting coming in the future. But what that looks like, I think the legislature is going to still need to determine. And I think you'll have a lot of different ideas about how best to do it. And some of the bills we're looking at in the House that are priorities revolve around special education and the escalating costs for our local boards of education and thereby the municipalities. Again, we're looking at child care, which I mentioned earlier, and investments to that to help stabilize that and get people more affordable health, child care so they can go back to work, which has become a growing problem. And we're also going to look at housing and homelessness, looking at programs around that as well. So those are some of our priorities. And also an environmental bill that we passed out of the House last year that didn't make it. We're going to try to run that back as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Speaker Ritter, you mentioned right there at the top, of course, the big topic this legislative session is going to be the budget and specifically how you all in the legislature and the governor deal with the caps around state spending that were put in place in 2017. A lot of members of your caucus in the Democratic Party believe those caps are too restrictive when it comes to funding priorities like education, childcare, special education, housing, all of those things. What do you anticipate will be the resolution of this fight over what they call the fiscal guardrails? You are obviously a principal negotiator between the legislature and the governor. Tell us what you think that resolution will look like. There are some people who, the Republicans particularly, who are steadfast. They want those fiscal controls to stay in place. There are some members of your caucus that would like to, I think maybe a handful that would like to do away with them altogether, but I think the more common position is to simply amend those fiscal guardrails to allow a bit more spending. How do you think this is all going to shake out, Speaker Ritter?
Yeah, I think it'll be a compromise in the middle. You have two camps. You have one camp that says that the guardrails are untouchable, that one amendment thereto shall ruin them. And that's not an accurate position. And then you have others that say you have to get rid of them entirely. They've done no good. Well, that's not accurate either. So surprise, surprise, the answer is in the middle. And you have people on the extremes on both ends. And my job is in my caucus to bridge that divide and bring people together and get the governor and to go along with that as well. And I think we will. But I think the most important thing to remember is when we did the guardrails in 2017, and I was the House Majority Leader and was in that room when we did it, very different time in our state, right? Much worse budgets. But also that was pre-federal tax code changes that came in President Trump's first year of his presidency, which God, as many remember, capped SALT deductions.
Yeah.
You just say, what the heck does that have to do with the guardrails? Well, our income, the revenue that we put into this volatility cap, and boy, we're getting into inside baseball, the money that we put into the pensions.
Yeah.
We picked a baseline number and then we allowed it to grow, right? Mm-hmm. But there was no, the business entity tax, right? The pass-through entity tax was a very small revenue for the state of Connecticut in 2017 because you had unlimited SALT deductions for local property taxes and state income taxes. When that got capped at $10,000, which they did in 2017, a lot of LLCs, LLPs, think of an accounting firm, to save their partners money, they began to, they found a workaround which involved the entity, the business entity tax or the pass-through entity tax. That is now bringing in a ton of revenue to the state, and it was never contemplated back in 2017. So just intellectually acknowledging that and saying maybe the number was set too low because the tax code has changed would be one way of sort of, I think, intellectually having an honest conversation about maybe, yeah, spending a couple hundred million dollars more. And what would that mean? That the projection right now, instead of putting $1.3 billion in the pension fund, we might put $900 million in the pension fund. And, you know, as a fiscal moderate, I think that's a pretty good balance, actually. I think if you're putting way too much in, you're either overtaxing your residents or you're sort of overburdening one generation with all that problem. And probably better to spread it out a little bit. I'm not saying put zero, but a split of maybe $400 million more in spending and another $900 million in pensions seems pretty reasonable to me.
And tell us, you just mentioned President-elect Trump, what he did in his first term. I think another thing that will loom over this legislative session in 2025 is whatever it is that the new administration ends up doing down in D.C. There may be a number of different ways where Connecticut is impacted, and you might find yourself at odds with the federal administration. How do you work through that, as Speaker Ritter, as the leader of the State House of Representatives?
Yeah, you know, you raise a good question. Here I'm talking about investments we want to make in the state, you know, child care, special education, Medicaid rates, higher ed. You know, that may come crashing down. We may be playing some defense. I don't know what changes they'll make to Medicaid at the federal level. And we may have to backfill some of the funds. I don't know what they're going to do to health insurance and the subsidies that the Biden administration has provided on the exchange. I had the commissioner of DEEB call me and say she was afraid they could be down $50 million alone in some of the grants they've gotten.
This is the Environmental Protection Agency for the state.
Correct. And that was a shocking number for me to hear. So you look at all that and you go, well, yeah, there is a possibility that you are on defense more than on offense. And our caucus is prepared for that. We expect if that happened, if the state saw massive federal cuts, that the governor would declare a fiscal emergency and all the guardrails would be suspended for purposes of backfilling. Right. I could definitely see that happen. The governor, you know, if you lose $700 million in Medicaid, what are you supposed to do?
Right.
You just hope that in 2 years Congress is changed or there's a change of heart. You know, I was talking to Senator Blumenthal the other day, and he also mentioned a good point. You know, we don't expect a federal budget till the summer or at the earliest, probably the fall, early, you know, September, because their fiscal year starts October 1 of 2025.
Right.
We hope to have our budget done early June, late May. Mm-hmm. So we could also adopt a budget and find ourselves in special session very quickly as well.
Right, right. We're chatting with the House Speaker here in Connecticut, Matt Ritter. Speaker Ritter, you recently rolled out all of your picks to lead the key legislative committees down here in WICC land. We know Jen Leeper very well, being here from Southern Connecticut. Tell us about picking her to be the new chair of the Education Committee and what that will mean. So many of these discussions over the budget are going to revolve around education and the aid that the state gives to local school districts.
Yeah, I mean, look, doing committee assignments, chairs, vice chairs, the whole committee is a hard thing. I'm really proud of some of our new chairs, like Representative Leeper and Representative Berger-Vallo, also Fairfield County. It's well represented. Education's a big one. And, you know, last year we had a massive education cost sharing formula increase for our boards of education, one of the largest in state history. But there remains challenges. And I think I mentioned special education. The House and Senate have created a select committee to really look at this issue. And it's not just money, right? It could be other things they have to look at. But it'd be a very high priority bill this year. Most small towns, right, if you look at their mill rates, if you look at the driver of cost, everyone gets angry at the Board of Education. Well, it's not the Board of Ed spending frivolously, and it's not the town in many cases. It's often special education, right? Federal requirements attached to that. So we really got to think about how we're going to help our municipalities and try to create a more equitable system than we have right now.
Chatting with State House Speaker Matt Ritter. We're going to take a quick break here on WICC, but when we come back, we're going to chat more with Speaker Ritter about the role of being the House Speaker. He is really one of the most influential leaders in the state capitol, but you might not hear as much from him as you do from the governor or some others. So we're going to chat more about the role of the State House Speaker and the future looking forward to 2025. So stay with us here on the Mike Cerulli Show. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC, continuing our survey, if you will, of the Connecticut political landscape with the State House Speaker, Democratic State Representative Matt Ritter from Hartford. Speaker Ritter, it occurs to me sometimes we have on this show Attorney General Tong or the governor or the lieutenant governor or Senator Blumenthal, and folks are really familiar or at least somewhat familiar with the role that all of those folks play. They see the attorney general suing big corporations, suing the federal government when that has to happen. They see the governor obviously responding to crises and signing bills. One thing they might not see up close, even if they do listen to the Mike Cerulli Show and tune into News 8, they might not see the work of the legislature or the work that you do. And I think it's now an interesting point to ask you about this because it was just a very interesting profile of you written by our friend Mark Pazniokas in the Connecticut Mirror. If someone comes up to you on the street and says, hey, what does the Speaker of the State House of Representatives do? How do you view that job? You almost have a similar problem, right, to Sean Scanlon or someone who says, nice to meet you, Mr. Comptroller. What is that? What do you do? What do you do, Speaker Ritter?
Yeah, I still ask Sean what he does half the time, too, so I share that.
He takes a lot of selfie videos, I know. That's part of the job description.
He does. He's got nice hair, so he can do that well. Look, the Speaker is a fascinating job. I think what makes the Speaker and the Senate President unique in Congress, both nationally and at the state level, is first you got to get elected, right?
Right.
And then your peers elect you. And it's not just your party, right? I mean, yes, the majority party gets the Speaker, but as you probably saw with Kevin McCarthy down in Washington, everybody gets a vote. So when I tell people that in grammar schools or middle schools, they're like, wow, you got a lot of people who can affect your outcome. And it's like, yeah, right. So actually on January 8th, we're voting for Speaker. It's actually a motion. I'm technically not elected yet, although I have the votes to do so. So it's unique just in that alone and how you get elected by the entire chamber and you have to get elected in your own right. But the main power of the Speaker is, I think, is at the end of the day, you control the bills that get called, right? You pick the committees, so the committee chairs and who goes on them. And obviously that's a big deal because the people that you put there have a lot of discretion. But at the end of the day, the main power is no bill gets called without the Speaker of the House. And so that is a lot of pressure. Look. 80 to 90% of the bills we call are pretty bipartisan, not a big deal. I work well with my majority leader, Jason Rojas. We figure it all out. But where the real hard part comes is finalizing those more controversial bills. So, A, you're part of every negotiation, and you have to be knowledgeable about everything, right? I have to be willing to go in and understand the most controversial bills, whether they be energy policy or education, and work with your staff and the chairs to figure that out. And then hopefully get those bills ready and then ultimately to call them. And perhaps the most controversial part of my job is when I don't call a bill, right?
Right.
People call it a pocket veto or anything like that. But there are hundreds of bills that ultimately do not get called every year. And that's not just me. But I would say if you've, you know, in many times I'll have to talk to the caucus or I may have personal opposition or think a bill's not ready. And, you know, if you don't call it, it will not become law.
Interesting. And as you said, you're elected by your peers and listeners to the Mike Cerulli Show will know that not only do the Democratic members of the House support you, but we have Greg Howard and Tom O'Day on this show quite a bit, and they always sing your praises, too. You said before the break, you mentioned the phrase govern from the middle, and I think that was such an interesting phrase to hear from you because your party, the Democratic Party, is sort of going through this period of self-evaluation right now following the election. Your party in Connecticut did pretty well. You picked up a handful of seats in the state house, but nationally, of course, we saw this very pointed shift away from the Democrats. Do you believe you have something to offer to this conversation right now as someone who's been able to be successful, not just electorally with picking up a few seats here in Connecticut, but also philosophically, right? You do seem to be able to build bipartisan consensus. I mean, Tom O'Day and Greg Howard are no wilting flowers in the Republican Party. These are principled conservative legislators. who praise your leadership as across the aisle. What do you think you could maybe offer to your party in this moment of sort of self-evaluation?
Yeah, and I've read all the articles, and look, I'm not an expert on national politics, so I can speak a little bit to Connecticut. The biggest mistake that Democrats make is we lump people together and assume that they are monolithic in their views. And that's particularly true of urban voters, right? We have this notion of the Democratic Party almost taking it for granted, right? Well, Hartford is going to vote Democratic 90%, or Bridgeport 90%. And it's based upon a variety of assumptions, right? It's a variety of I think, misunderstandings about how diverse people's views are, both on economic issues and social issues, based upon their upbringing, their cultural, religious beliefs. And I think what I try very hard to do is to get to know the legislators. I don't typecast them based upon something. And it frankly is mostly white liberals who do that. I mean, that's a pretty blunt statement. I understand that. But you'll get these white liberals elected from a suburban town, and they approach inner city legislators in particular as if they're this monolithic block that is sort of agrees with their views of the world as they sort of learned their quote unquote liberal policies in poli sci class at, you know, Khan College.
Yeah.
And it's just wrong. You know, it's just wrong.
Right.
And it's, you really have to actually ask people questions about their upbringing and what they think. And so the dynamic of the Democratic Party, it's not a problem that our party is both urban and suburban and rural and has rich people and poor people and everywhere in between. I think the problem is we've made too many assumptions, and you really have to dig deep with people to understand where they're coming from. And more importantly, if they don't agree with you, you got to get over it.
Yeah.
Because my wife and I love each other very, very much. We don't agree on everything. Shock. Right.
Yeah.
And yet for some people, it's like, well, if you're not 99, if you're not 100%, you're not my kind of person.
Right.
The Republicans don't have that problem. I mean, they fall in line, in my opinion, behind a candidate who has many challenges morally and ethically and some things that he says and does, but they fell in line. And our party, you know, if you're not 100%, you're a problem. And that's just not real politics, and it's not how the world works anymore.
How do you view the next few years shaking out in Connecticut politics? You know, you and I hear all this time, Mr. Speaker, that, you know, who's going to run? Is Governor Lamont going to run for a third term? If he doesn't, who's going to step in? I think your name has been floated in these conversations about potentially, you know, running for higher or other offices. What do you kind of see happening over the next? I know it's a huge and loaded question, but I always find that interesting to hear from you. Like, there is this sort of call it a logjam, right? Of a lot of Democrats, young Democrats with ambition, including in your caucus. There are a lot of statewide Democrats who are eyeing the top job. And there's a governor who doesn't know if he wants, or says he doesn't know if he wants yet, to run for a third term. 2025 will be a year when we expect to hear his decision. And so much, I think, hinges on his decision in terms of what the future of the leadership in the state looks like. What's your sort of general thought for 2025 when it comes to the future of leadership here in Connecticut? Because it is really a definitive moment will come, we expect, let's say, mid-2025, right?
Yeah. Well, I-95, it's kind of backed up, right? I mean, just going back to November, right? Vice President Harris was going to be the president.
Yep.
Senator Murphy was going to be, you know, some big job. Congresswoman Hayes, you know, all these rumors. He was gone, and everybody was going to move up, and there was going to be all these things. And then, of course, that all came crashing down.
Right.
And, you know, those are all just rumors. But that's, you know, that was the scuttlebutt. And, you know, I'll say this, right? The governor has publicly said he'll decide in the summertime after the session. And I truly think he's not decided one way or another. My instinct tells me that he would be leaning towards running. But I think just like anybody who's done something for a long time, you want to really make sure you're all in, right? And that's not the kind of job you can be 75% in. So I think he, you know, if I had to guess, he's leaning there, but he acknowledges that a bruising 6 months or 7 months, and it's a long time in politics, you know, maybe it's not the right thing. But assuming that he does run, I mean, people have to make decisions. And but I always say in politics, there is a little bit of luck and timing.
Sure.
And people hate that answer because I meet all these people and they're ambitious and they have their list and they're going to be this year. And then, you know, they have their life planned out like it's an ingredient to cook a cake.
Yeah.
Make a cake. It's not. And you have to be flexible and nimble. And I always just tell people, if you do a good job, you could be the city council person in Weathersfield. You could be the mayor of Danbury. You could be on the board of finance in Thomaston, Connecticut. If you do a good job, opportunities, your name will get talked about. Opportunities do come your way. And you have to be flexible. That's the reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think about that stuff personally for you too? I mean, again, not to touch on this again, but it was recently reported about you that you're entering what will we expect, and I think is pretty much guaranteed, a third two-year term as speaker. That matches the historic record, which we should note for our listeners here. Your father is one of the people who holds, who's held that job for three terms. Four would be the record. How are you thinking about that right now? And do these conversations about the bench, the folks coming up after you even, do those factor into your thoughts when you look towards, I know we're talking about like, you know, several years down the road here, but it is the scuttlebutt. Yeah. It is what everyone's talking about right now.
Yeah. What I have said is that I have not ruled out running for a fourth term. I can say that I've talked to enough of my colleagues to know that if I decided to do that, I would have the support to do that. And that includes, you know, Republican as well. They have not objected to that if I chose to do it, assuming that we were in the majority. But, I'm not going to decide probably till August or September. Certainly what the governor decides could have an impact on what I decide to do.
Right.
So what I'm going to do is do what I've always done. I'm going to work really, really hard through the first week of June and get us through a productive session, keep us on time, work with the other side, work between the different factions of my caucus, try to do a great job for our state. And then I'm going to go, you know, watch all my son's baseball games and all my daughter's lacrosse games have a really good summer and be a lawyer. And then, you know, when I get to the end of August and I got to start making a decision again, then I'll make it. But probably the difference between me and other people is I like politics. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But I don't love politics. I don't tweet about it all day. I can't stand doing parades.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just have I'm just different that way. And that probably makes me not as suitable for some of these offices because I'm just not willing to do some of the stuff that you have to do. So if I ever ran for something, I would be knowledgeable of my own limitations, and you would just have to acknowledge people like, look, I'll go to the town committee things and I'll do what I got to do, and I'll certainly do the job. But the people who can spend 18 hours a day doing politics, I admire them.
Yeah.
We are very, very different people.
Yeah, totally. Hey, Speaker Ritter, before I let you go, it's kind of a left field question here, but we've been talking a bit about the reporting on you. I am curious about this as a young journalist. You've been in the legislature for a while now, but you're still a younger guy in terms of the political world. Have you noticed a change in terms of how state politics here in Connecticut is covered? Because people always tell me these stories of back in the day, there used to be dozens of people cover, you know, reporters from all the newspapers and TV stations, and you know, the types of profiles that were written on you used to be written about a lot of different people here in Connecticut politics. And now it kind of seems like a little bit of crickets sometimes in the press corps. What do you make of how politics is covered, and how does that affect your legislating?
No, there's no doubt about it. We have some mighty Capitol reporters that have been there a long time. You mentioned Mark Pezzi, right? You got Ken Dixon, you got Chris Keating, you got Paul Hughes, and but the reality is, there's probably not as many people who just cover the state capitol. When I started, the Hartford Courant probably had four people that covered the Hartford Courant, including columnists.
Wow.
You know, I think what I tell people is it does make a difference because for me, I read the paper every day, which may shock some. I get all my ideas from newspapers in many cases or know what's going on. I mean, I read what's so to not and I read blogs and I spend about an hour every morning reading. And I can't imagine how you get information other than social media or word of mouth without doing that. So it does leave a gap. And for me, I think for the flip side of that, though, Mike, is people just don't read papers anymore, right?
Yeah.
So that reflects where the country is. And that's another thing that elections have changed, whereas information just comes from different places and people are going to have to get used to that. Podcasts, TV, radio, it's just not papers anymore. But there are still some really good reporters. They do a great job. And, I would encourage anybody who's young and wants to get into politics, pick up a paper.
Yeah.
You know, you'll learn a lot about what's going on in your community still, even with the sort of lack of coverage that can occur, far more than I think you will on Facebook.
Yeah. And I'm trying to bridge the gap too a little bit. So House Speaker Matt Ritter, thank you so much for joining us on the Mike Cerulli Show. I'm sure we'll have you on again in the near future, and I'm sure we'll touch base. Enjoy the holiday, all right?
Thanks, Mike. Happy holidays. Talk to you soon.
Have a good one. We'll be right back here on WICC. The top ranking Republican in the State House of Representatives, Vin Candelora from North Branford. Vin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here, as always. So we've been hearing from a lot of different legislative leaders over the last few weeks here on the show, and I just want to start by asking you the same thing I've asked all of them. We are right around the corner from the 2025 legislative session. You are, as I said, the leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives. You lead the largest caucus of Republicans up in Hartford. Tell us what we can expect, what you expect to prioritize for your caucus in this legislative session.
Yeah, I think obviously protecting our fiscal guardrails and making sure that we're not overspending and keeping taxes in check is one of our biggest priorities. We hear a lot right now about the demands on our budget, and Democrats want to erode sort of the fiscal guardrails, the restraints that we have in place to avoid that overspending. So that'll probably be one of the biggest priorities. You know, the other thing is how we work with our federal government. You know, immigration is a top issue. Certainly trying to get our criminal immigrants off the streets and out of Connecticut is going to be a priority. No question, we're going to have to be reacting to what is done at the federal level. And I think Connecticut needs to be better poised to work in collaboration with our federal government rather than in opposition. And then finally, energy costs. You know, we continue to see the rating companies now downgrading our utility companies throughout Connecticut, which is only going to translate to higher costs for our ratepayers. And I would like to work with the governor's office. They've got to come up with a plan. You know, complaining about our electric companies is not the way to make things cheaper.
I hear you. Let's hone in on one of those issues, which I find interesting. We've talked on this show a lot about the guardrails and energy costs, and I want to get to those with you soon. But one issue I think is kind of undercovered, and I say this as a reporter here in Connecticut, is the issue of immigration. We heard just a few weeks ago a murder in Stamford allegedly committed by two members of a Venezuelan street gang, including, I think, both of the individuals who are suspected and under arrest for that murder are here without legal status. And one of them actually is was what they call a getaway, right? Someone who actually isn't even awaiting an asylum hearing. They're someone who is evading immigration enforcement right now. So tell us what you expect from the federal administration and what you expect. Obviously, we've seen posturing from Connecticut mayors that are saying basically, hey, if ICE comes and the sort of examples they use are if ICE requires us to be reporting, you know, for example, students who are here without legal status or folks that interact with the city in other ways who are here without legal status, we will defend them. But it sounds like Tom Homan and the incoming administration are really going to prioritize what they call threats to public safety, people who are wanted on immigration detainers, I think they're called. What do you think this is going to shake out? Because it is odd, right? We're a blue state. We're saying we're going to posture against federal immigration enforcement, but there are clearly public safety threats from people who would be subject to deportation if they were caught. Tell us, Vin Candelora, what do you expect to shake out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is sort of a politicization of a very important issue. You know, right now the Trump administration is not talking about mass deportation of every illegal immigrant in the country. It's just not feasible. But we've got to start having that conversation about open borders have allowed anybody to come into our state without any vetting. And we are seeing the heightened criminal activity occurring. People are being sex trafficked. We are seeing more drugs coming into the state. And so we need to cooperate to make the streets safer for our residents. That's where we have to have that conversation. In 2019, the Democrats changed our Trust Act in Connecticut that essentially ties the hand of law enforcement to work with federal authorities under any circumstances. And we've got to peel that back because we want to make our streets safer. It's a different time. You know, we're now seeing the gang activity coming in, organized crime nationally, which is a problem. And to say that we're going to be, you know, deporting students is not the way to start this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, this is just my own read of it as a reporter, is I think a lot of people probably would recoil at the idea that, you know, school districts are going to be reporting undocumented students or whatnot, but sort of question why authorities don't cooperate more on handing over these folks who are being arrested for violent crimes. Are there things that you can do at the state level to advocate for this other than using the pulpit that you have, Vinny? Or is it really up to the majority Democrats to say, hey, we are going to cooperate either as a state or individual municipalities?
Well, right now we have a state law on the books that says that you cannot communicate with ICE unless the person's been convicted of a felony.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's got to be peeled back because we know that there could be people that might be charged with felonies, people that might have been arrested in other countries. And it might make sense. So they're on a terrorist list. That's worthy of allowing our law enforcement to have conversations with ICE. So I think we've got to reform our state law, which is too dramatic in saying you can have no communication. And what I would say is we need to be able to have getting dangerous, either felons or dangerous people on terrorist lists off our streets.
So let me just get this straight, Vinny Candelora. You're the House Republican leader. We're chatting with you here. Let me just get this straight. So state police, right, driving down 95, they pull over somebody who's going at a very dangerous criminal speed. Maybe that person confronts them. Maybe there's drugs found or weapons found in the car. And that person is placed under arrest for something, let's say, more than just criminal speed. Let's say that the police conduct a search of the vehicle and find drugs or weapons of some type. That person obviously has a presumption of innocence, as anyone does in this country, but they're under arrest for drug and gun crimes. The state police can't reach out. If they run that person's name or identity and find that, hey, ICE is also looking for this person because they're here without legal status and they're wanted by immigration authorities, maybe they have ties to some transnational gang, as they call them. A cartel might be another word for that. State police can't reach you, can't pick up the phone and call ICE and say, hey, we've got this guy. You're looking for him. We just caught him doing something kind of dangerous. We think he's guilty of a pretty serious crime. They can't, under the current state law, do that. They can't just call up ICE and have ICE take that guy off their hands.
So my interpretation, that is correct. They cannot. And so it's only upon conviction. And that's sort of why you've seen this catch and release system in the state of Connecticut, where we have, you know, an immigrant who is arrested on a crime. They could even leave the country and come back in. I think it just most recently happened with the woman that was sexually assaulted while she was intoxicated, and the person was released without conviction on a promise to appear, or they post bail, they disappear. So unless there's the ability to have some kind of hold, the court systems end up having to release these alleged criminals. And the difference between a Connecticut resident being arrested versus an immigrant, the immigrant can slip back into the shadows and then repeat their crimes. And that's why they are so dangerous. And the way the laws are written, our hands are tied.
Interesting. So this is going to be a top issue for you, Vinny Candelora. We're going to take a quick break and chat here more with the House Republican leader. You're listening to the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. Stay with us. And welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. We are continuing our conversation with the House Republican leader, Vin Candelora. We were talking about immigration as an issue in this upcoming legislative session, of course, with the new administration coming into D.C., vowing a crackdown and a mass deportation effort that would, of course, probably cause some consternation from the Democrats here in Connecticut. Another two issues that we're talking about in terms of the legislative session, of course, is the fiscal guardrails. And that is something you've heard on this show in the news a lot. Vinny, there seems to sort of be, I spoke recently with the House Speaker, and he sort of puts people in two camps. He says, look, there are people who believe the fiscal guardrails are sacrosanct, so the numbers that were put in place in 2017 can't be touched. That's one camp. And then he says there's another camp that basically says, blow them up, get rid of them. And he believes, Speaker Ritter believes, that the solution will ultimately be somewhere in the middle, where you basically are going to have this, compromise on the guardrails where some of that money gets released, but not all of it, and some semblance of the guardrails stay in place. What do you make of that, and what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of an oversimplification of where people are. You know, what's left out in this is that inflation allows us to spend more money in state government if we want to. And that's what sort of the spending cap speaks to. We'll potentially be allowed to spend up to $1 billion of additional money. That's about a 5% increase overall of our budget that we would be allowed to spend. The speaker talks about the volatility cap, and maybe we should adjust that threshold so not as much money falls into sort of our savings account, for lack of a better word, and we could take that money and spend it. But that argument neglects to recognize the fact that we have $1 billion that we can spend. And if Democrats want to go above and beyond that $1 billion, there needs to be a justification as to why. Because those guardrails, sort of guide you on what you can afford. And there could be a time, in emergency circumstances, that you need to go above those guardrails, like if you have, for example, a pandemic that hits you. But we're not in those situations right now. And so to say we have to spend above and beyond an additional $1 billion that we've already been given, it is a little bit concerning to me, because that's how you're going to slip into deficit. If you overspend, that's how you're going to be looking at tax increases down the road. So the question is much broader than just these guardrails. It is, do you want to set Connecticut up for fiscal disaster and for tax increases? And I think you do that if you go beyond the framework of how much you can spend.
And Vinny, you believe that's what's on the table here. We've heard that from other Republicans that, hey, if they blow up the guardrails, we basically might revert back to that sort of Malloy era period of constant fiscal crisis, where the only way out, and in that case didn't really get us out until the fiscal guardrails were put in place, but the only way out would be tax hikes. That's what's at stake here, you're saying.
Potentially correct. And, this year alone is a great example. The Democrats refused to do a budget. They gaveled out without making adjustments. I and my Republican colleagues were highly critical of that. But we left office with a $400 million surplus because of the revenue cap, which created that surplus. That surplus is gone. It's spent. Medicaid overruns were a big reason for that. So we went from $400 million in July to zero today, less than 6 months later. Had those caps not been placed, we would be looking at deficits, and we would be looking at deficit mitigation. So that's why these caps are so important. And we don't even have a conversation of what just happened this year. People want to ignore it and gloss it over. But the reality is those caps saved us from having to do deficit mitigation and cutting vital programs.
So, Vinny, one of the things that the speaker said to us about potential fiscal emergencies, and we're going to go back to the conversation about the incoming administration, is the speaker Ritter said, look, we don't know what the federal government is going to do in terms of tax policy, in terms of health care policy, particularly if some stuff is done to eliminate or pare back the exchanges. Could there be a situation, and I'm reminded that the timing here isn't necessarily the best either, where you all should be resolved with your budget by May or June? The federal government might set their budget later that year, potentially October. Could there be a situation when the sort of what's happening at the federal level puts Connecticut into a shortfall, particularly when it comes to Medicare? Is that something you're looking at on the horizon as well?
Well, no question. And that's why you need to keep the caps in place, because with our revenue cap, that puts a reserve in place. If there is some sort of federal change which causes an emergency, we will have that money stockpiled to address that emergency. What Democrats want to do is they want to take all those guardrails and just spend all the money now. So to try to make an argument that federal changes is going to have to cause us to do this now is really disingenuous.
Okay.
And in fact, those guardrails are going to be the things that protect us if we have a shortfall.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I don't think Speaker Ritter was saying, hey, this might happen, so we should bust the guard. He was just sort of generally saying, this could happen,
right?
And it would be, because the governor does have this fiscal emergency power, right? If he declares a fiscal emergency, he can just sort of do whatever with the caps. But again, that's sort of a remote possibility, depending on what happens in D.C. Speaking of all of these issues, right? We talk about finance, we talk about taxes, we talk about energy and electricity bills. You rolled out recently your announcements for your members to lead on these committees. So every committee is bicameral. So there's two Democrats that co-chair it and two Republicans that serve as the ranking members on two of those really key committees, in the finance committee, the one that writes the taxes, and on the energy committee, the one that helps regulate and set energy policy. You have two new Republican House leaders there. Tell us about those two members, one of whom is familiar to the show audience here, and tell us about what caused you to pick them and what you hope to see from them in this upcoming session, Vin Candelora.
Yeah, I think, you know, Holly Cheesman has served as our ranking member on our Finance Committee. You know, she served us very well. Unfortunately, she was not reelected, and so that required a change. I've appointed Joe Paletta, who represents Watertown and part of Waterbury. And I think he's served on that committee a long time. He's a veteran member of that committee and has sort of that reputation of taking some of the tough positions and advocating our Republican position. And I anticipate, you know, with the overtures that we're seeing, it's going to take somebody, a strong advocate, to really push back on some of these policies, in particular of eroding our guardrails. And so I think, you know, Joe is going to be up for the task on that. You know, our energy committee, we're mixing it up a little bit. And Tracy Mara is out of Darien. She's, you know, very well read, gets into the weeds, has done a lot of work for our caucus on AI and some of that more complicated legislation. And I think where energy has gone, it was time to try to make a change on that committee, because what's happening right now is not working. So we're seeing right. our rating agencies downgrading, our utility companies, they continue to cite the volatile market of regulatory environment and the unpredictability of our regulatory environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to try to bring some certainty to it. So we're going to have a lot of proposals, I think, in that area. Bill Buckby had served as ranking. He's going to continue on that committee, and we're going to come out with several different agenda items to try to at least fix the government piece of it, to try to make energy more predictable and therefore more affordable.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things, not to keep bringing it back to Washington, D.C., but we're talking about energy. One of the things the governor has told me recently is that some of the federal energy policies, which obviously we expect the Trump administration will put folks in place, particularly Governor Doug Burgum, who are very strongly favoring more American energy production, some deregulation to make it easier to get those energy sources online. And one of those sources, particularly important here, us here in Connecticut, is nuclear energy. The governor believes that Millstone nuclear power plants can be, the capacity there could be expanded. It's possible that they will do some deregulation of the nuclear energy sector. Is that something you'd support if the federal administration and the Lamont administration could come together and say, hey, we want to get another reactor online at Millstone?
Yeah, it's funny. I think the two areas we have to look at is natural gas and nuclear. And I think we've been saying it all along. You know, Democrats, including the governor, have put all their money and eggs into wind and solar. And the governor finally retreated after he realized that it doesn't make Connecticut more affordable. And so he's starting to embrace the Republican policies, which is important, because with a Republican federal administration, there are opportunities to bring natural gas and potentially more nuclear into the state of Connecticut. And that's going to be an important conversation, because the other sources of energy, while they could fit into our portfolio, are just very, very expensive, especially for New England.
Right, right. And natural gas, to expand the supply of that, Vin Candelora, you basically, as I understand it, you could widen the existing pipelines, you could bring in additional pipelines, but probably widening them is probably the easier option than building and siting new power, new gas lines.
Yeah, and it all hinges on the cooperation from New York. And I think that's sort of been the sticking point, is New York does not want to expand into Connecticut. But we've got to work on that and make that happen, because we are a cul-de-sac, and we need that energy.
That's a good way to describe it. So any other priorities, Vin, for you as we head into the session? We've hit the three big ones, I think. Obviously, the guardrails, energy policy, and we've talked a bit about immigration. Are there any other areas as the Republican leader in the House that you're going to be prioritizing yourself?
Well, I think overall, you know, we've heard about the disconnected youth. There's been a lot of studies saying many of them never came back after COVID. You know, I certainly see that, having children that were impacted in their education with that pandemic, that we've got to put more of a focus on COVID recovery methods. And for our children, because they never got came out of it. And so whether it is sort of workforce development for them, looking at special education delivery and cost recovery for our towns, because those costs have skyrocketed, I think we're going to need to pay attention to that issue.
Actually, finally, I want to ask you about one more thing. So I kind of lied to you there. I have one more question for you, Vinny. The other day, recently, we saw the governor roll out a new hire for state government in this office related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. They don't call it that, but that's what it is. What do you make of that? It seems like one of the many lessons people are drawing from the November election is that nationally, there is this move away or rejection of some of the more, coastal liberal conventions, one of them being the DEI sort of scheme. What do you make of the governor is sort of, now the plan, I guess, originally had been to hire one of these people for every state agency. It seems like they're just going to have a central office for it now. What do you make of that, and what do you think of that from a sort of taxpayer perspective and also from a policy perspective?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary. You know, I think it is sort of a feel-good position that potentially is going to waste tax dollars, just like the disinformation officer that was hired in the Secretary of State's office. I'm still not sure what they did or accomplished during this last election cycle. We need to start focusing on the core functions of government and stop with the window dressing. And I think a position like that is just window dressing. The state of Connecticut should already be seeking diversity in their hiring practices. We have laws all over on the books that, prevent discrimination or, right, make it a crime or illegal civilly. But then additionally, we have a worker shortage, not just in state government, but also throughout the state of Connecticut. It would make more sense to put efforts into going into these disadvantaged communities and get these kids trained for positions than have some ivory tower DEI officer looking at people's resumes. I think we've got to have more fundamental fixes there.
Yeah. Well, good point to leave it on that one. I'm sure we'll talk to you more soon, Vinny. Thanks for joining us here on the Mike Cerulli Show. You've just listened to Vin Candelora, the House Republican leader. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back here with more of the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. Stay with us. Now by our friend, frequent guest here on the show, Patrick Berlin. Patrick is a Republican campaign operative. He's the chairman of the New Haven County Young Republicans. And he's, I think, a really interesting voice in Connecticut politics because he's around my age. He's 24. I'm 23. And I think provides a really good window into those Republican efforts to reach younger voters. So, Patrick, with that, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me on.
So we're heading into 2025, and I thought it would be kind of fun if we could do a little bit of a New Year's resolution segment with you here, Patrick. Patrick Berlin's advice for the Connecticut Republican Party as we head into 2025. Now, we've had, in the last few weeks here on the Mike Cerulli Show, a lot of legislators, Republican and Democrat, talking about the guardrails, talking about energy and electricity, talking a little bit about immigration. I want to take a broader step back here and talk with you about, if you had the ear, which I think you do, they listen to this show, right, of some of the Republican leaders, the Vin Candeloras, the Steve Hardings of the world. Obviously, we know you probably back their efforts to protect the fiscal guardrails, to lower energy costs through the policies that Republicans support. But what else would you be telling them in this moment as Republicans seem to have this momentum, particularly among younger male voters? Patrick Berlin.
Yeah, I think they are doing a great job trying to hold the majority accountable and advocate for responsible fiscal solutions and productive energy pathways. I think it just came out this morning that Connecticut has once again the highest energy bill in the country. It's really one of the big issues that I think we can sort of build on and press upon. It's important to maintain a cordial relationship, the Republicans in Hartford with their Democrat counterparts, but maybe on the wish list is to sort of impress upon voters more aggressively that all of the things that we are seeing, the high cost of housing, the high cost of living, the high cost of energy, are the result of uninterrupted, unified, unchecked Democratic control of Connecticut. And so we really need to be aggressive and talk to our voters and talk to, you know, communities in Bridgeport, Hartford, in places that we're losing ground in Fairfield County and out east, and really say, like, hey, your Democrat representatives, they might seem like the very nice people that are your neighbors, but in reality, they've given their votes away to Democratic leadership that doesn't care what you think. And I think if we start being more aggressive on messaging, we can sort of build on the enthusiasm that you've seen nationwide in this election.
So, Patrick, I'm hearing what you're saying here, and it is, we've talked about this dissonance, right, in Connecticut. On the one hand, Donald Trump did pretty well in the election. He made a lot of gains in Connecticut cities. On the other hand, both Vin Candelora, who we've just had on the show, and Steve Harding, who's a frequent guest, they're both going back to Hartford short a few members. Steve's down one member, Vinny's down like four or five. So what's that dissonance there? I mean, Republicans are losing seats on the shoreline, which maybe you could say, okay, that's a permanent political realignment. We talk about the higher education, wealthier voters shifting Democrat. That's probably going to manifest in a place like East Lyme pretty heavily. The same way, you know, the Jen Leeper seat in Fairfield is probably a pretty solid Democratic seat for the future. But when we look at, like, for example, Kara Rochelle's seat in Ansonia, why didn't something like that go, right? I mean, now there were probably some candidate problems in that race, but for those that are familiar, you'll know what I'm referring to. In these working class areas, why did a Rachel Chileski in the city of Danbury, why did she go down when Donald Trump improves his margins by quite a bit? I'm sorry, is Chileski Danbury or Waterbury? I forget. But Trump did well, better in both those cities, and she lost. So what do you think's going on there?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a change up. I think that, you know, our party did remarkably well punching above our weight for a number of years because a lot of Democrats who, you know, are sort of common sense people looked at the way that Daniel Malloy was steering our state and for years had sort of lent their votes at the state level to local Republicans. And now sort of as polarization has kicked in, you're seeing maybe Trump improve in the state on previous Republican performances, you know, albeit marginally, still hovering around the 40%, 42% mark. At the state level, we are suffering heavy losses, I think, just because Democrats can't run on their record. So what they're doing is they're trying to make this a moral or religious litmus test, saying, you know, that this is a national election when really it's about, you know, what's the price of energy in our state? What are the taxes like? What are the regulations? How many new units of housing are being built? So, you know, I think in one sense, it's polarization and it's aggressive policy and nationalization. In the other sense, I think we have to look at, you know, we can't rely on crossover voters as much necessarily just inherently coming to us because of dissatisfaction. Ed Lamont is much more affable than Daniel Malloy. The bipartisan budget that we fought for in 2017 and 2018 has you know, improved things, obviously not to where we'd hope. But we have to start talking to people about getting involved in the campaign machinery. And races like Ansonia, we need more volunteers. If you're someone that lives in Ansonia and you voted for President Trump and you're upset that, you know, you're represented by a very far left Democrat who sells your vote away to some leader in Hartford, well, you can get involved in your local Republican town committee. You can donate, you can volunteer. And, you know, you look at New Jersey where the margin has shrunk, it's because a lot of people got involved for the very first time. And I think we have to do more of that.
So when you say be more aggressive in some senses, what are you referring to? What do you think they should be doing? Is it being on more platforms or is it literally being more aggressive? Of course, yeah, still maintaining that famous Connecticut civility that we're famous for. But where do you think that the Republicans could really press on offense, Patrick Berland?
Yeah, I think we have to point the finger a little bit and say, look, their record's a failure. And just be more clear to voters. And I also think it means investing in, you know, year-round infrastructure. The Democrats have a natural, system where – of patronage where, you know, they have much more state jobs where they're able to essentially have these political appointees go in and do these government jobs, you know, 9 to 5 and do even political work within those hours in some cases. And then after, they're able to help do campaign stuff and they're able to cultivate this infrastructure. So what we have to do to counter that, I think, is to really get smart about bringing grassroots members back into our RTCs, building up local infrastructure, and, you know, reinvesting more money into our campaign committees for the House and the Senate, you know, sort of raising money a lot earlier, recruiting candidates a lot earlier, and figuring out a blueprint for how people can volunteer on campaigns. And maybe we should be settling up on our candidates in primaries and do less divisiveness. That way we're not stuck in ugly contests. Like, I think there was a few districts across the state where that was the case and several seats where we meanwhile left on the table without a candidate running. My seat in the 114th was uncontested by Mary Wielander, who's a great person, but you know, this is a seat that was held by Themis Clarides not so long ago.
Yeah, and you just tell people where you live, Patrick, because this is one of those communities where you would think, given the national profile, that the Republicans could probably be doing better, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I live in Woodbridge, and Orange and Derby are part of the seat, and it's changed a little bit. But, you know, overall, I think, you know, we have to get better about talking to qualified and interested people and encouraging them to run. A lot of people don't think of themselves as natural, you know, candidates for political office because it's nasty. But I think in Connecticut, we have to, you know, at least change the dynamic where we're bringing more people onto our side so that we can contest these very winnable seats.
You're listening to Patrick Berlin. Patrick is a Republican campaign operative. He's the chairman of the New Haven County Young Republicans. We're going to be right back with more from Patrick as we break down the year to come in Connecticut politics here on the Mike Cerulli Show. Stay with us. You're listening to WICC. Our conversation with Patrick Berlin, Republican campaign operative from Woodbridge, the chairman of the New Haven County Young Republicans. Patrick is given his advice, New Year's resolutions to his fellow Republicans on things to do, particularly as it comes to reaching out and appealing to younger voters. Patrick, we were talking before about getting people to volunteer with the party, getting people to actually run for office, also some of the candidate recruitment challenges that Republicans have had in the last couple of years. One of the big conversations for Connecticut Republicans is going to be, and it's a sensitive topic for some Republicans, but it's going to be whether or not Ben Proto continues to run the Republican Party. I believe they're due for that formal leadership vote sometime early this summer. Patrick, you're a pretty plugged in guy. What's your read on the situation? Is Chairman Proto, is he well positioned? I know there's some discontent that's been directed at him from some corners of the party, but not necessarily a challenger who's lined up yet. What are you hearing, Patrick?
You know, I'm someone who you know, has in the past in various functions, you know, looked at leadership and have had my quibbles. But with Chairman Proto, this is a guy that has been at the game a very long time. He's very experienced. And, you know, there's, you know, are there things that, you know, any state party, especially, you know, in an opposite controlled state can be doing better? Absolutely. But I think he has demonstrated that even in a presidential year, we held our losses to a minimum. We kept some of our congressional races, you know, in the margin. You know, there's definitely some people that, you know, may want to challenge him, but I think it's definitely going to be an opportunity for us to talk about, you know, what we should concretely do better and have a substantive conversation rather than, you know, a referendum on him. He's done a great job as chairman. I've gotten to know him a little bit over the past few years. I think he has done a tremendous job. And to those that are critical, I mean, I totally understand where they're coming from, but I think this is a really a game of addition. And so it's very, very much needed for anyone who has feedback or ideas about what we can be doing better to win elections to, you know, join the collaborative effort.
The other thing, Patrick, that's going to be happening in 2025, aside from a potential leadership fight at the top of the Connecticut Republican Party, is it's a municipal election cycle. And some of the more major cities are up for re-election this year. We know New Britain Mayor Aaron Stewart is not running for re-election, so that'll be a tough open seat. Danbury Mayor Roberto Alves, who interestingly enough is appears to be have the support to be the incoming chair of the Connecticut Democratic Party, he's up for re-election. Are there any municipal races that you're watching, or are those two kind of the main ones in your mind? Because again, we've been talking about the Republican gains in cities. I could imagine a pretty aggressive push for those two mayoral seats.
Yeah, those are definitely on the top of, I think, everyone's agenda. I also wouldn't count out, you know, West Haven, New Haven, and other, you know, cities where we could make gains, you know, at least at the ward and selectman level. I think, you know, it's important that we shoot for the moon, but and try and knock out, you know, the West Haven has been run by a cabal of corruption for the past few years now. And, you know, that's a place where they need new leadership. They've been completely insulated from the consequences of their reactions. They've had close elections recently. So I think, you know, those are some additional targets. New Haven saw a bit of a shift to, you know, President Trump at the national level. I think we could probably build on that, maybe pick up a few city council seats. And that's how you begin to make inroads in communities we haven't, you know, done well with in the past.
Interesting. Yeah, I think, New Haven would be a pretty heavy lift, but certainly West Haven, as you mentioned, not only have they had to deal with political scandals with the former mayor and obviously the state representative who was indicted, but, you know, it's a tougher town to begin with than New Haven is. So that'll be interesting to watch. Any other suburban races you're watching? I'm assuming, I think it's like, I know Trumbull is up. I know a lot of the suburban towns have two-year, almost all of them have two-year cycles. Any ones that stand out to you in the suburbs, maybe?
I certainly think, I know Greenwich, the RTM that they have, I think it's important that we sort of, you know, make sure that we're holding our seats and pick up some more. That's a longtime Republican stronghold. I think Woodbridge and Bethany, this is going to be, I think, only our first or second time where we're going to be having, you know, November municipal elections. Typically, we've had the old farmer calendar election where we would vote in May.
Yeah.
So, I think obviously there's issues in Bethany. That, you know, they're
right.
They need to school look at a board, new candidate. Yeah. I think certainly suburban towns like those are going to be important places where we can win some seats. And those are people that could eventually look to run for office in 2026.
Right. And on the topic of 2026, we are looking. I know there's some people who listen to the Mike Cirulli Show who go, hang on, why are you talking about 2026? We're about to enter 2025. But Patrick Berland, as chair of the New Haven County Young Republicans, you've got your finger on the pulse of the up-and-coming generation. Where do you sense the energy is in terms of 2026? Are people picking their candidates yet? Is Aaron Stewart kind of seen as the leading gubernatorial candidate? Is Heather Summers or Ryan Fazio or Rob Sampson, any number of these folks? Is Tim Herbst coming out of the woodworks? What are we looking at? Because next year, 2025, really is the year all this kicks off. Aaron has said she'll make a decision by early 2025 on what she wants to do. The governor, of course, is making his decision mid-2025 on whether or not he'll go for three or not. And so the starting gun is being fired within the next few months. Where's your head at on all this stuff?
Yeah, it's early days. It's very early for sure. But as you said, it's, you know, we have, you know, just a few months of, you know, probably downtime with the holidays before a lot of these people need to make up their minds about whether or not they want to run. And, you know, the past few cycles, I think with the exception of really 2022 for governor, we've had, you know, somewhat divisive primaries that went way, way too long, way too nasty, circular firing squads. I would hope that perhaps some of these prospective candidates could get together and work out some arrangement where, they pick a running mate and we pick our attorney general candidate and we sort of get people that are excited to run and qualified to run in position so we can sort of avoid a contested convention and protracted primary. Obviously, it's a big lift considering what's gone on the past few cycles. But I think people like Ryan Fazio, people like Rob Sampson, people like Aaron Stewart could do very, very well for various offices. And I think that they would, together as a team, be very strong, especially if the Democrats ditch Ned Lamont and put in someone as unpopular and potentially liable to lose like Susan Bishewitz.
So, Patrick, who's a name we're not thinking of right now? Who's a name that's not in this conversation that should be in this conversation about the future of the Republican Party in Connecticut?
I mean, we've talked about him a little bit, but Ryan Fazio is obviously a very young Republican leader who I think would do great. Joe Canino is a new addition. He's one of the two Republican flips of this cycle. He flipped a seat in Torrington, as you know, and I think he's someone that maybe he's not running for necessarily higher office in 2026, but he's someone that could be running it in the very near future. And, you know, communities like his are the ways that you put together a House majority or a statewide map where a Republican is winning at the governor level. So I think Joe Canino, someone like Peter Lumage is sort of not in the conversation right now. But a Lumage or a Joe Hoxha, I mean, these people are from places that, you know, we need to win and continue to increase our margins for statewide success.
Well, Patrick, very convenient that you mentioned Joe Canino, because as we bid you farewell here for this year on the Mike Cerulli Show, I can tell our listeners that coming up after this break, you're going to hear from Joe Canino, the Republican state representative-elect for the great town of Torrington. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for setting up our next guest, and I'm sure we'll talk to you a bunch in the new year.
Thank you for having me.
As always, good time, good conversation. So stay with us here. We're going to hear from State Representative-elect Joe Canino after this short break here on WICC. All right, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show. Thank you for spending part of your day with us. We've got on the line now someone I'm very excited to have on the show. It's Joe Canino from the great, is it town or city of Torrington, Connecticut? Whichever, it's still a great place to go. He's a state representative-elect, was just elected this past November, flipping a seat from blue to red. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. And yes, it is the city of Torrington that I'm proud to represent.
The city of Torrington. Got it. So you'll be sworn in early in 2025. Congratulations on that, Joe. And the reason I wanted to have you on the show today is because you are the youngest incoming Republican. I know MJ Shannon on the Democratic side has got you beat by a few years as the youngest overall incoming member, but you're a young guy, you've been working in politics, and now you've just flipped a seat from blue to red. So one of the bright spots for Connecticut Republicans in this election, we hear that all the time from leaders. They point to you as someone who's sort of the next generation of Republicans in this state. So for the audience down here in WICC land, tell us just who you are, where you're from, what you're kind of about, and what drove you to run for office.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Yeah, so my name is Joe Canino. I'm from Torrington, Connecticut, born and raised there. I've worked in the building, in the legislative office building for a couple of years now for a couple different lobbying firms first, and then became a press secretary for State Senate Republicans. So I've always been kind of interested in this sphere, and decided to run for the big job, for state representative, to be the voice for my community. You know, I grew up in Torrington my whole life, and I've seen nothing but friends, family, and businesses leave the city and leave the state. And I wanted to do something about it, and hopefully I'll have a chance to promote some common sense policy that promotes affordability, public safety, and government transparency in Torrington.
So I mentioned at the top, you flipped a seat from blue to red. Torrington is a red town. It's sort of one of these working class, middle class communities that has, I think, shifted more Republican in the last few years, had been represented by a pretty moderate Democrat for about 15 years. You put an end to that. You are now the Republican in that seat. I wonder, when you're out knocking doors, which I know you knocked a ton of doors around your hometown for this race, what were the primary issues you were hearing about? You just mentioned a few. Were those the ones you're hearing about most at the doors?
Yes, I mean, the number one by far and away was energy rates. I mean, it was very topical because it was when everyone was feeling this burden. We had a very hot summer, but also we have some policies on the books that make our energy much more costly than other states. And you look at the public benefit charge, which is, you know, a whole slew of different charges that are put in there based on public policy decisions by the state of Connecticut. I think we need to take a look at that this year, see if there's anything we can shift onto the budget and other things that we can get rid of entirely to save ratepayers some money. Public safety is another. You know, you hear statistics thrown around that crime is down in Connecticut, but you ask these people on the streets, crime isn't down for them. Reporting is down. They're seeing the brazen crime. They're seeing the car thefts in broad daylight. They're really concerned about the future of this state. And so they want a government that's going to hold criminals accountable and deter that type of crime from happening in their community. The other is government transparency. People want their government to be open with them, to explain what they're doing, to not pass 700-page bills at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when they were written and emergency certified at 9 o'clock in the morning. The people expect a lot of accountability from their government, and I hope to bring that to them.
Yeah, it's definitely the public safety thing is definitely that's real, right? You hear, and it's you and I have talked about this, right? Where there is sort of this anger at the political establishment on the one hand for being perceived to have not done a good job on issues, for example, crime or the cost of everyday goods, and then sort of adding insult to injury, then saying, no, this isn't a problem, right? So,
right.
And again, I'm not here. I'm the balls and strikes guy. Like, I'm not here to say who's at fault for rising prices. But the fact of the matter is, prices have risen over the last, call it 5 years, and that's undeniable. And you could say that the year-over-year inflation is improving, which it is. But if the response to a mother who is you know having trouble buying food for her kids is, well, the year-over-year inflation is actually improving. Don't you know that? You know, it's sort
it's a
of like
tone deaf. Yes.
Yeah, well, it's a little condescending too, right?
Right.
And the same would go for public safety. Again, we can see the uniform crime report. We can see the homicide numbers. I think in some of those categories have actually improved. But then again, and I'm a little bit younger than you are, Joe, but like, I have like multiple friends who've had their cars broken into or stolen and, you know, either out of their driveway or in neighborhoods that they thought were pretty safe. And that obviously we've all seen the videos on social media of the Kia boys careening down streets. And I think there is this disconnect among a lot of public officials where it's like, yes, facts and statistics and numbers matter. It's really important that we have those right, particularly when it comes to policymaking on something like, you know, climate change, right? Like, I don't really have any time for someone who says, hey, you know, there's actually not increasingly hot summers year over year. But on the same token, like, there is this this sense of sort of, you know, don't believe what drives are telling you. Did you sort of find a way to kind of harness that in your election and sort of talk not just specifically about these issues, but about people's attitudes towards what they were hearing from politicians?
Absolutely. I mean, I think anyone can see that there's a growing skepticism these days over what is being conveyed to them by their government. And that is because of the manipulation of statistics and just general gaslighting that can be kind of present in this sphere. Like you said, people are being told to not believe their eyes when, you know, right in front of them, like you said, these crimes are happening in areas where they've never happened before. We're seeing new problems sprout out across Connecticut. And, you know, even if you are looking at the statistics, while violent crime might be down statewide, I think, if I'm not mistaken, property crime actually rose. So that's exactly what we're talking about.
There are categories. Yeah, definitely.
Yes. So it's, you know, it's all about encouraging people to do their own research, to talk to as many people as possible about these issues, and not to get your news from one source only. Mm-hmm. So the right or left, an echo chamber is good for nobody.
Right.
You know, watch Fox News, but also watch MSNBC, you know, get those multiple perspectives so that you can make the best decisions on your opinion on the issues from both sides.
So we're chatting with Joe Canino. He's a state representative-elect from Torrington. He's the youngest incoming Republican, flipped a seat from blue to red. Joe, we're talking about lack of trust in government, frustration with policymaking. That's one thing when you're campaigning for a job. Now you've toppled the incumbent. Now you are the incumbent. You are the guy in Hartford. You are the politician. You are, in many ways, the government, right? What do you plan to do when you get into office? What are some specific policies you're going to be pushing to try and back, you know, work back on some of the things you've identified, and how do you maintain that connection to the community now that you are the guy, right? Like, you are the right. You are the one with your hands at least on 1/187th of the lever of power in the legislature, right?
Right. Well, of course, as I said, energy is the biggest issue that I heard at the doors. And, you know, I'm very much willing to work with Governor Lamont to increase energy supply here in Connecticut. He's been very vocal about his ideas for increasing supply, because any basic economic student will tell you, when supply goes up and demand stays the same, prices go down. We need a better capacity to create energy here, and that includes all of the above strategy. So not just subsidizing, you know, the fad green energies of the recent past, like solar and wind, but also expanding nuclear and natural gas. You know, natural gas is much cleaner than any other petroleum, and it is a bridge to that green future that we all want to get to. These things cost an enormous amount of investment, but the right investment in the right place could really make a huge impact on people's bills. So that could be providing incentives for new development of nuclear and natural gas akin to the ones we've been seeing for renewables. I mean, we'll have to see how it all shakes out financially. But by picking and choosing winners and losers, we are not doing anybody a good service.
So, Joe, I mentioned you're 27 years old. Let's say, hypothetically, I'm sure this has probably already happened to you at some point, but let's just say hypothetically, we just had Vin Candelora on the show. Let's say he calls you into his office and he says, look, Joe, Connecticut Republicans, where national Republicans did really well, picked up the White House, won the Senate, won the U.S. House, made gains across the country. Connecticut Republicans had actually the opposite happen to them. Lost a seat in the state Senate, including the state Senate district that you're a part of, at least part of your district, mm-hmm. I believe is part of that district, and lost a handful of state House seats. You were one of only two flips in the whole state for the Republicans. If Vin says to you, what did you do, Joe, particularly as it comes to you being a young guy, there's all this op-eds and editorials and podcasts about how young men are becoming more Republican, what would you say to your party right now that they could learn about not just reaching voters generally, but reaching particularly young voters, young men, the people that seem to have helped put President-elect Trump over the edge in this year's election?
Well, there's two parts to that question. So, I mean, first, I would say doors, doors, doors. If you are running for office, you need to be willing to hit thousands of doors in your district, because there's no replacement for direct voter contact. That is the person-to-person, you know, human contact, going to their door, asking them what their beliefs are, and making yourself vulnerable to any platform positions that they might have an issue with, and being okay to have that awkward discussion with them to see if you can find common ground. I knocked over 6,000 doors in Torrington, and it really paid off. I mean, I only won by 54 votes. If I even knock 1,000 fewer doors, we might not be having this conversation. And as for the reaching the younger audiences, social media is a wonderful tool. Using content that is, you know, not just the same thing every time of you just talking to a camera, but switching it up, maybe utilizing some memes tastefully, just things that get people interested, that catch younger people's eyes, and really coming up with a message that, you know, we want to create victors and not victims. A lot of young men, they have spent their entire lives being told that they are racist, sexist, misogynist, whatever is you want to throw their way, and they are cut down every step of the way that they go. This Republican Party is telling them, you are a human being, your opinion is valued, and that we want to build you up into something that will be a productive member of society, no matter what your race, sex, color, or creed is.
So tell me, Joe, you know, nowadays you mentioned the silos and the echo chambers and all that. You know, we do live in this world of knee-jerk reactions. So you're a young guy, you know, a lot of young people, as many gains as Republicans did make with young people, a lot of young people still have this knee-jerk reaction. They hear the word Republican and they have a very visceral negative reaction. So if someone were to ask you, like, what kind of a Republican is Joe Canino, right? Are you a Trump guy? Yep. Are you a MAGA guy? You know, and I know, again, I'm making you put yourself into a category here, but this is the world we live in, right? When you turn on these legacy media platforms and it's like there's MAGA Republicans, there's never Trump Republicans, there's old school Republicans. Where do you see yourself in the spectrum of Republicanism and conservatism?
Yeah, no, I mean, it may be a cop-out, but I really struggle to put myself in one box. I mean, I did vote for Donald Trump in this election and the past election. I truly believe in his vision for this country.
Before anyone gets on your case, says, well, he must not have voted for him in 2016. You weren't old enough to vote in 2016, right?
Well, no, I was, actually. Oh. I used to be a Democrat.
Okay. I didn't know this about you. Interesting.
You didn't? Okay, yes, yeah.
When did you make that change?
Around 2017, 2018. I was at one of the most liberal schools in America, George Washington, right smack dab in the middle of D.C., and, you know, I really didn't think that I had done my research on conservative talking points, so I started listening to a lot of the younger commentators like Ben Shapiro, Michael Knowles, Charlie Kirk, and was kind of exposed to a whole different world that, you know, slowly but surely shifted me to the right. And I would consider myself just a traditional conservative. I mean, I'm very much of the school of thought of Milton Friedman in terms of economic policy, but very, you know, traditionally conservative myself. I also recognize that I have a district to represent. And so some of my social views, which I've been vocal on, such as abortion, you know, I'm pro-life, may not be in agreement with where my district is at. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you know, I would not vote for something to put their views in jeopardy when they don't agree with me.
So, like, not that this will ever come up for a vote in Connecticut, but abortion, stuff to limit access to abortions, you know, or roll back the protections Connecticut has right now, you wouldn't be in favor of that because you would say, hey, your district, what you hear on the street is that that's a no-go.
Right, yeah, I'd have no interest in doing that.
Interesting. Even though your personal beliefs, you're in a different position personally.
Absolutely. If public opinion was a little bit different, maybe, but I really don't see any appetite for that for the people of Torrington that I represent.
Any other issues like that where it's like, hey, my personal views are here, but the district might be in a different spot? Is there anything else, or is
nothing
that kind of
that I can really think of off the top of my head?
Got it. All right. Well, Joe Canino, I think it was great for the audience to get to know you. I think you're going to be a name people are going to hear a lot from down the road, and of course, we'll continue to have you on the show as long as you'll dial in. We'll have you on the show as the legislative session kicks off, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me on.
Yep, that was State Representative-elect Joe Canino from the city of Torrington. He's the youngest incoming Republican legislator, flipped a seat. Really, a lot of Republicans say he's a rising star in the party, so we appreciate his time, and we'll be right back on the Mike Cerulli Show. You're listening to WICC. Stay with us.